going to open a work session on House Bill 2251. Finally. Grant, why don't you come up and tell us how wonderful the tunes are. Short little amendment.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state public health officer with the Department of Human Services. And indeed, after a rather long working session with a number of groups, primarily the Oregon Medical Association, the Hospital and Health Systems Association, and the ACLU, OEM, and Department of Human Services, I do believe that we have a bill now with these amendments that we all agree to. And as we've discussed before, what this bill is doing is giving the governor an additional tool. Short of declaring an emergency, the governor would be able to declare an impending public health crisis that would authorize Department of Human Services to have some limited additional public health authorities to try to make sure that that crisis did not hit Oregon, or if it did, that we were ready to respond. And so as we go through the amendments now, and this is basically a gut and stuff of the original bill, Section 1 just goes through that the governor may proclaim a state of impending public health crisis. There was a lot of work done here to make sure that the language was such that it was saying that it really is restricted to those issues that do have a severe, widespread, life-threatening potential. Subsection 3 simply states that this in no ways affects the governor's ability to declare a state of emergency, and that in the case of a state of emergency, the governor could do anything that's in this bill. And then subsection 4, and again, thinking that this is going to be a short-term measure, and then it's either going to lead to a state of emergency or disappear, that there is a 14-day life of the impending public health crisis that can be extended if that is expressly extended by the governor. Section 2 then goes into the authority that are given to the Department of Human Services, and 2A says that we can adopt reporting requirements that are specifically related to the public health crisis. Subsection B talks about creating diagnostic and treatment protocols that are new that would have to be done with consultation of appropriate medical experts. So again, this is not something we're just pulling out of the air. Three, we would be able to order public health measures that's actually provided in other parts of statute. D, that we would be able to take other reasonable administrative actions. Again, there needed to be some limitations put on that so that we couldn't simply do anything we wanted to, and so that's why the language upon approval of the governor has been inserted. And then E gives us the ability to impose civil penalties for people who knowingly disregard the actions that have been taken. And then if we move to page 3, the rest of 2 was dealing with the civil penalties. If we move to 3 on page 3, it also gives us the authority to have access to medical records, here described as individually identifiable health information, to be consistent with HIPAA language. Subsections A through E make sure that we're only using this for issues related to the impending public health crisis, that it would not be used for other things is what's discussed later on in this section. And then down at the bottom, starting at line 25, it talks about who we can give this and share this information with. And again, it's people like the individual themselves or their legal representative, the state, local, or federal agencies to determine the cause of death. And now we're on page 4, directly to healthcare providers that are involved in the evaluation or treatment of the condition. The subsection DD, starting on line 5, says that we cannot disclose this information upon expiration of the state of impending public health crisis. And then starting on subsection 4 on line 14, this is all HIPAA-consistent language, and is the reason that has been added is to make sure that if we are going to be dealing with medical records, that we are consistent with HIPAA.
As we know it today.
Right. As we know it today. And that takes us then to the bottom of page 6, which is section 3, just saying that all penalties, civil penalties, would go to the general fund. Section 4 now on page 7 says that the governor can use the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, EMAC, during a state of impending public health crisis as well as during a state of emergency. And then Section 5 says that during a state of a public health crisis or during a state of emergency that our immunization registry system can be used as a system for vaccination management and tracking, and actually not only for vaccinations but for the administration of antibiotic prophylaxis as well. And that when we're using it that way, that it is not limited to children 18 years old or younger, and that we would be able to share that information. The bulk of the rest of this deals with our ability to use isolation and quarantine during the state of impending public health crisis, and that starts with Section 7. And so there is a change on line 26, and then on page 8 on line 16, which again, those two things are just making certain that we could use these authorities during the state of a public impending public health crisis. There's a lot of pages then that do not have any changes. We now move on to page 19 and 20, where exactly the same language has been inserted into another portion of the quarantine law. And then the final two changes. One is on page 30, which again in the quarantine laws adds the conditions as the basis of a state of impending public health crisis as again one of the things that we can use quarantine laws for. And then the final changes amendments are on page 32. Where again it's adding to the quarantine law, and what this is a temporary restriction of movement, that if we have reason to believe that a person should hear information and provide us with contact information in case there is a need to act on a certain disease, that we can limit that person's movement to give that information out and to receive contact information prior to letting them go. And that if they do not comply with that we could use public health measures similar to quarantine and isolation.
Questions? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. A couple of questions, Dr. Higginson. First of all, is there a definition of public health crisis?
Chair Cruz and Representative Mona Sanderson, the definition is in Section 1, subsections 1 and 2. That is the language now that would be defining a impending public health crisis. So it's widespread, life-threatening, and of a scope that requires immediate action.
Right. So
and then in sub 2, it talks about can result from bioterrorism, chemical or radiological contamination, pandemic, influenza, and other unusual or extraordinary incidents of communicable reporting diseases.
And then one other question is... when regarding sort of release of information, and the idea came when you were talking on page 2. So are you saying that there doesn't need to be a release of information, or there does need to be a release of information from the person, but these people can be notified of or the lists that you give? Anyway, I want to understand the process here, that you don't need a release of information if you can't get a hold of the patient. This would allow you to share information, say, with a therapist or a psychologist or a social worker, as in the bill, if you can't find them and you know that this person's a threat to society, so to speak?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mona Sanderson, what this allows us to do, and remember, it's just information that's related to the impending public health crisis, but we can see the potential for times when we would want to go in and look at a whole clinic's records to see if there were people who might have been exposed to a particular pathogen. And if that's the case, we would not be able to get prior informed consent, and so we would have then access to do that. If we did indeed find that there had been some people that were exposed, then without getting informed consent, we could contact that patient or a legal representative. We can contact another provider if that provider was providing care to that patient. We could also notify other state and local public health authorities if that was appropriate as well.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Dr. Higginson. Could you describe what immediate medical action is taken in an impending health public health crisis? Can you sort of walk us through the steps?
Okay, and Chair Cruz and Representative Dalto, are you referring to a specific section here?
No, just generally.
Yes. Well, and it would all depend on the on the particular impending crisis. But again, if we use the experience that we had with anthrax, when we're talking about additional reporting requirements, one thing I could see is requiring reporting of any unusual skin lesion. And so that would be beyond anything that we currently report. But to have that information and then be able to talk to the healthcare provider and follow up on that would be something that we may want to do. When we're talking about protocols, one thing that we might want to do in the way of new protocols after talking with medical experts would be to say that the only people that are to receive prophylactic ciprofloxacin are only those people who have had a exposure to a credible threat. And that anything beyond that would be going against standard practice. And so that's the kind of things that we might want to be able to do.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Yes. Last time we were talking about the fact that this needs new language needed new language to seek dollars from the federal government. Did I miss where that might have been placed?
And Chair Cruz and Representative Anderson, I'm not remembering that part of our discussion from the last time. But we currently are receiving grant dollars from the federal government. This is not a requirement to get those dollars or continue to receive those dollars. A lot of what is in here, though, is things that are things that have been recommended from work that's been done at the national level on looking at model laws around emergency preparedness.
And there would be adequate funds to do what you need to do in this bill.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, this bill we do not see as having a fiscal impact. It's similar to what we have in 401 right now around the declarations of emergencies. That doesn't cost us anything to have that in statute. However, if there ever was an emergency or there ever was an impending public health crisis, that may have severe fiscal repercussions, but that's something we would have to deal with, and we just can't say if and when this would ever be used.
Thank you. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you referred to HIPAA, but is this in violation or would there be conflict with federal law at all?
Chair Cruz and Representative Mona Sanderson, the reason that this language, additional HIPAA language, was added, my understanding, is to make sure that there would be no conflicts with HIPAA. And this was really done at the suggestion of legislative counsel and with the concurrence of the partners that we've been working with.
Any other questions? Dr. Higginson, I've looked at this, and why I was interested in this from the beginning was basically what we're attempting to do here is give us the ability to respond below crisis level, because we're in a new world where that sort of response might be appropriate and necessary. So, I mean, that's really what we're doing here.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. That is the intent of this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this? If not, we're in work session. I would entertain a motion on the Dash 2 amendment.
So moved.
Representative Anderson moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2251. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 2s are adopted. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I move the 2251 with the amendments to the House floor with the duplex.
Amendment.
Pardon me?
Just two amendment.
No, just the Dash 2. That's
dash
it.
Two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We could either do the ones or the twos. They don't fit together. One replaces the ones replace the bill, and the twos replace the ones. So we just missed a step there. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Excused. Aye. House Bill 2251, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'm going to carry it.
Okay.
This is a major policy issue. I don't think it belongs on the consent calendar. So I will close the work session on 2251. And because we have a senator in the room, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Senate Bill 434. Senator Dukes. And Senator, I know your time's precious. If you want to speak to both of them, you may.
Oh, so. Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, I'm Joan Duke, state senator from District.
In fact, Senator, I'm going to also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 436, so we can officially let you talk to both.
Okay, well then, officially for the record, I'm still Joan Duke, state senator from District 16. As most of you have been around the building for a while know, I've worked on pain management issues for about a decade now, and last session the legislature created a pain management commission. And I have with me today Kathy Hahn, who is the chair of the pain management commission, and Ellen Chino, who is a member. And at the commission's request, I've introduced Senate Bills 436 and 434. 434 adds something to the governing statutes for each of the practicing medical licensees. Simply says that the boards, the governing board, should encourage the effective management of pain. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward, but it's something, it's sort of taking us the next step. Often when we deal with medicine, we think of some of the things that we've been doing for a lot of years and the curing aspect. That's for most of our existence as a country, it's pretty much been we tried to cure. And if we couldn't cure, we didn't really know what to do with it. We had some other kind of remedies that people used and, you know, in the chicken soup category, and some of them worked and some of them didn't work. And we have come light years from that. And today we know that people should not have to be suffering in pain. The medical experts that I work with tell me that 95% of all pain is treatable, and yet we have hundreds of thousands of people out there who are in pain, constant, continual chronic pain. And while this will deal with both end of life and chronic pain, the real focus is chronic pain because that's the majority of the people who are out there suffering. For this state, it's Oregonians who may not be able to work because of their pain, who may not be able to continue in a family situation. We have, as I'm sure you're all aware, people who are in substantial chronic pain often end up divorced. We end up in abuse situations. It's total frustration. We end up often with addictions as they try to treat themselves. What we want to do is to get them into the kind of appropriate medical care where they can be reasonably managed. And Senate Bill 436 simply encourages the boards to set that as one of their priorities. It's not replacing anything else. It's not, you know, a big mandate. It's simply saying when you're dealing with your licensees, one of your goals should be effective management of pain. And I said 436, didn't I? And I meant 434. 436, let me get my bill out and say that I'm not a morning person.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I know I'm not alone.
Well, it's noon in New York.
Thank you, Representative Westland. And I think it was 95, the legislature passed the intractable pain bill, and there may still be somebody here who remembers that besides me. And then in, I think it was 99, the legislature amended the intractable pain bill, again, trying to get at these same patients who, there's a definition in the statute, I believe it's in the statute, for intractable pain. And then once a doctor determines that a patient is suffering from intractable pain, there are certain things that they can do. Basically, what it comes down to is that they can prescribe narcotics, and we're not going to get as excited about that because we understand that narcotics are one of the major treatments for intractable pain, and that they work differently with somebody who is in severe pain than they would for someone who's not. We know that if you are in serious pain and a narcotic is the reasonable treatment, that you're not going to become addicted, for example, that the medication knows to treat the pain and not go to an addictive situation, whereas if you don't, then you become addictive. One of the things the intractable pain bill required when it was amended was a second opinion. Once a physician determines that they have a patient who is suffering from intractable pain, before they can treat that patient, the statute requires that they send them to a specialist in that part of the body where the pain is. In the Senate, for example, we had a woman who testified that she had been to a dentist for, and I forget how many root canals she'd had and all of that, because she had pain that they were relating to dental. And it turns out the pain was something else entirely. But if she'd been sent to for a second opinion, she would have been sent to another dentist and never would have gotten what she actually needed. We have been recognized nationally by the folks who deal in pain management as having, in the state of Oregon, as having this statute as our major barrier to effective pain management. By the time a pain patient gets to a physician who knows what they're doing and who can treat them, find out what's going on, and treat them appropriately, they have almost undoubtedly been to a long litany of physicians. And they will tell you over and over again how many they've seen, how much money they've spent, and they finally find someone who understands them and who can treat them. And according to state law, that person is not allowed to treat them until they send them to another physician. And again, it's a physician who may have nothing to do with the pain. For example, they could, if you have stomach pain, you could be sent to an internist. Well, that may not be the appropriate specialist for you to be seeing. So what 436 does primarily is to remove that section of the statute that requires the second opinion and acknowledges that if you find a specialist who knows what's going on with you, who has diagnosed you as having intractable pain and knows how to treat you, let them treat you. You have letters from two physicians, Dr. Paul Stahl from Astoria and Dr. Reinhardt from Salem. You may be familiar with the Reinhardt Clinic. I think we're in our fourth or fifth generation of Drs. Reinhardt, and the clinic has been going on for a very long time and has an excellent reputation. And both of them are writing in support of this bill and trying to explain. In rural parts of the state, finding that second opinion is very difficult. Taking someone who is in intractable pain and sending them halfway across the state because you don't have a specialist in, you know, that part of the body in your area is not fair to someone who is in that kind of pain, is expensive, thereby running up our health care costs again, or running the person who is in pain further into debt, and it is unrealistic. So we believe that there's probably the Board of Medical Examiners has testified that they've been asked to override this particular statute once. Now, we know that there's a lot more intractable pain being treated in the state than that. And we know that these people are not all getting sent to second opinions. So I think that this section of the law isn't being followed today. Have no statistics on that. That's just my sense from being out and working with folks who deal with treating pain. But I can tell you that it is a major barrier to effective pain management. I've never been in that kind of pain. I can only imagine from the people that I've worked with over the years what it's like. And I know that I would not want to be there and would not want to be sitting in a doctor's office who finally gave me the diagnosis and told me what they could do about it and then told me they had to send me someplace else first. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Anderson.
It's been my impression that people with intractable pain will go anywhere at any cost. I agree with the removal, I think, of the second person. My main concern is, and I'm sure it's covered adequately, but just to check in terms of the code, the physician that gets into a corner and is prescribing narcotics gets trapped by a patient who really is pretty crafty. Maybe a physician, could be a dentist, could be a podiatrist, could be people who get into the situation thinking that the narcotics are necessary and are prescribing it much further than they'd like to. Are there provisions to curtail that? To keep the doctor safe, because it essentially says there's no to me it says they're allowed to prescribe and administer in the course of treatment and no disciplinary action.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the Board of Medical Examiners has been dealing with that very issue for a number of years and has sanctioned physicians for overprescribing and in one case for, well, at least one case, for underprescribing. They have rules. They have a training that they offer to physicians to understand where that fine line is, and it is often a fine line. One of the things that the legislature did last session was to require 8 hours worth of education for MDs on pain management. We're trying to get the education out there. It's a new issue. They only started teaching at OHSU pain management a few years ago, and I believe it's an 8-hour course. But there's more and more. There are a lot of folks out there teaching it. In fact, the Pain Management Commission is required to adopt, in conjunction with the licensing boards, the curriculum that will be used. So we're trying to get enough information out there, but ultimately the responsibility for them falls to the Board of Medical Examining.
Okay.
Examiners, the licensing board, and because they're the licensing board, people do pay attention to them.
Thank you.
Any questions? Senator, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Please.
I'm Dr. Alan Chino. I'm a clinical health psychologist, board certified in clinical health psychology. I'm a member of the Pain Management Commission here in Oregon. I specialize in behavioral pain management. I'm the president, or actually the immediate past president, of the American Academy of Clinical Health Psychology, which is a body of psychologists who have advanced training and experience treating medical conditions with behavioral methods. I have a considerable amount of experience setting up and administering and directing multidisciplinary pain management programs. I've done that in two instances in California, hospital-based programs, and then here in Oregon as well. Basically, what I want to keep this brief, but I want to address the issue of pain management and give you an idea of what it's like out there. In fact, there are individuals, real-life human beings, who I think are suffering and who are bumping up against these barriers to effective treatment. There are people who are suffering needlessly. And for those people who we've treated in a multidisciplinary context, where we have a lot of resources, we have physicians, psychologists, nurses, pharmaceutical specialists, physical and occupational therapists, tuning up these patients, we have a heck of a time getting them back out to their primary care doctors or finding a primary care doctor to take care of them once we tune them up and help them get functional again. It's a constant frustration, I think, for the patients and for us on the treatment side. where we see them get a whole lot better, and yet we fail in getting them back to the community to a doctor who feels comfortable enough continuing with the medication regimen or the other treatment regimens that we have recommended. So oftentimes what we'll see is that the patient gets back to their home community and they'll kind of slip back into the chronic pain mode. And, of course, that's not a good situation. We think that Senate Bill 436 will go a long way to reduce some of these barriers and get patients back out in the community, relieve some of the anxieties on the part of physicians who are, frankly, afraid to prescribe narcotics on a chronic basis for chronic pain patients. And as Senator Dukes mentioned, in fact, clinically it is true that people in chronic pain do not get addicted. Very rarely do we see addiction problems arise. We see a condition called pseudo-addiction arise, and what that means is that a patient may go visit different doctors to get pain medication, and the conclusion is immediately drawn that this patient's addicted and manipulating the system. Almost always that's the conclusion, when in fact what's occurring is the patient is not getting adequate pain management. We test that hypothesis in our multidisciplinary programs by providing the patient with increased levels of medication, and what happens is that the addiction-like behavior drops out immediately. So we actually have tested that hypothesis time and again and seen that once the patient is given adequate pain management, the problems that a lot of doctors in primary care see, those problems go away. So I simply want to lend to the committee my experience in this area and just say that this is a very important measure, and I think we're going to go a long way in solving some of the problems that real-life human beings bump up against here in the state of Oregon if we pass 436 and 434. Thank you.
Dr. You referred to the behaviors that appear to be addictive behaviors. And what might those be?
The primary one is doctor shopping, where a patient...
They're looking for a physician who will take care of their pain. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. What they'll do is they'll get a prescription from one doctor and perhaps go to another doctor and get a prescription for that same medication, which is obviously suboptimal in terms of managing the condition. But that's the kind of thing that once that's recognized is immediately branded addictive behavior,
right,
when in fact oftentimes it is not.
And so your remedy of that is what?
It's for the patient to be seen by one doctor to manage their medications. And
but
that
if I can just follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, thank you. But if that were the case, wouldn't the patient have stopped shopping?
Exactly.
I guess what I'm saying is if they went to the original doctor and the pain was managed, then they would not have felt the necessity to shop with another doctor, correct?
That's correct.
So then
the problem lies where, really, in my experience working with physicians, primary care doctors, they are anxious and nervous to prescribe narcotic medications on a long-term basis. And what they'll oftentimes do is prescribe in such a way that the dose is either too small or they will not prescribe enough. So the patient's pain, for example, may be relieved for a couple of hours, and then their next dose is not for another 2 hours or perhaps 4 hours. So they'll oftentimes run out of medications early and go to another doctor. That's
the problem. If the original physician was prescribing enough medication, then they would not have felt the necessity to go to another physician. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Just a follow-up on that. Some patients, Vicodin isn't considered a narcotic, though, is it?
Yes. It is.
Okay. Good. So this is a good illustration. Vicodin is very popular, and if someone does have a condition, they will go and they can actually sell. They will try to doctor shop so that they can get more medication so that they can actually sell it to other people or give it to other family members or something like that. So in a sense, he's right on when he says just one physician, because then he will know exactly how much is being prescribed and to whom, because Vicodin's hard to get and is very popular on the street.
Chair Cruz, if I may add just one comment, and that is one of the things that I would not like to see is that our practice of prescribing and of pain management be driven by the people who abuse the system.
Yes.
Oftentimes that's the case. The doctor is so afraid of being hoodwinked that the doctor will not be willing to prescribe enough medication to cover the patient. So I know that there are the horror stories out there and the people who have been damaged by the narcotic medications, but I'll tell you what, the research shows consistently that addiction among chronic pain patients is really a very small proportion, less than 1% in most studies. So I just wanted to put forward that information as well.
I'd also point out that even in that small percent, the choice of being mildly addicted or being in constant pain, I think I would take the addiction. But it's just me. Any other questions, Sir Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, the situation I was talking about before with Senator Dukes was more the patient that probably does not have pain but is seeking the Vicodin handout and goes to dentists and everybody else that they can find that will give them a prescription. My question to you is, and different conditions obviously will create different lengths of time of intractable pain, but is this a long-term situation, or can you get a patient out of intractable pain in a relatively short period of time, months, weeks, years?
The definition of intractable pain essentially is that it's ongoing and non-curable. The question is, and I assume the heart of your question is, can we get that patient stabilized in such a situation where they can be functional and start to live their life? And in fact, that is the goal of pain management. In fact, it is unrealistic to get them totally out of pain, but the idea is to get their pain managed to the degree that they can start living their life and be a productive member of society.
Or until the cause of pain shows up.
Indeed. Normally by that time, the patient's had quite a workup, and it's been determined that a cure is not there. So.
Any other questions? Before we get to you, Representative Hansen, I opened the public hearing on both 434 and 436, so you may talk to both.
Gary Hansen, State Representative, House District 44. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for opening a hearing on these two pieces of legislation that I think are incredibly important to people in the state of Oregon. I've been involved with the Pain Management Commission through most of the interim. And walking into the middle, I don't know what testimony you've already heard, so I'll be mercifully brief and try and keep your pain down to a reasonable level, too. The critical issues the state of Oregon can do with these two bills can improve the quality of pain management for people in the state that are indeed suffering. These are consensus pieces from the Pain Management Commission. They will greatly improve the climate of pain management as well as solve a couple specific barriers to people getting the pain treatment that they really need to live productive, comfortable lives. So I think with that, I just urge that you take action on these two bills because for people suffering in a pain situation, they're very, very important. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative, thank you very much. Do you want to show a movie?
We have an 11-minute video that really highlights the issues in a very concise way.
But no popcorn?
Oh.
You got a scone. What do you want?
Okay.
But they don't get
it. I think you got stadium seating. What do you need?
In fact, the other day I saw my son out
there. I'm not sure I know how to work it. Here we go.
I know I don't know how to work it.
Okay.
11 minutes.
Yeah, right.
It's like a long time. That's
a bone in the
bone. Still hungry?
Which I probably shouldn't have, but he was in the bone.
You're just going to eat your stone.
Oh, right.
Stones now. Fries and
pills.
Okay.
That was the big surprise for me, because I came in with almost a 3-inch chart of diagnosis by experts at Stanford and UC San Francisco, and these doctors saw this legitimate treatment that I had been on that had worked, and they were reluctant and downright hostile in even letting me be a patient. And after working really hard to accept my condition, that this was the way my body was going to be for the next 30 or 40 years, I was back to square one because of the way I was treated by these doctors.
I've had a lot of people talk to me, a lot of constituents and non-constituents alike, who talked about all of the pain, and it didn't make any sense to them the way they were being treated, and it seemed to them that there ought to be some answers, and they've been had difficulty finding someone who would take them seriously, who would acknowledge that they really were in the kind of pain that they knew they were in, and people who could understand.
With patients who are not treated appropriately in the acute phase, we oftentimes find that down the road that the cost has magnified threefold at least.
And my observation over the last few years has been that it's become very difficult to find physicians that will work with my patients in prescribing opioids or even just taking care of them in general. We have had the DEA come in because they perceive that we are a heavy narcotic orderer. And they have looked through all of our files and look for all the doctors that are ordering pain medications. This is pretty scary for both us and the physicians in our area, knowing that the DEA comes in and is checking out who is ordering what. And these are legitimate prescriptions that are going on.
We have seen institutionalized obstacles in the state, particularly the way the Board of Medical Examiners is applying the Intractable Pain Act. It's been a schizophrenic thing, because on the one hand we have a mandate from the people of Oregon through the Intractable Pain Act in 1995, as well as the legislature to invite and to encourage physicians to treat pain and to take away the past punitive past, and yet the very same law is being applied in such a way that doctors are still scared to prescribe. So we have a law that's being applied in a way which contradicts the intention of it in the first place.
If you have a medical legal authority, like the Board of Medical Examiners, who says one thing and does another, it creates such chaos. I called the Board of Medical Examiners in Oregon and was told, oh no, they have a ruling and doctors can treat chronic pain patients with opiates. No problem, they're not going to do anything to them. Then I talk to the physicians and they say, oh, I'm so afraid of them. I just don't want my practice looked at. I don't want to be hauled into Salem and miss days at work and just the trauma and my name being just dragged through the mud.
There's a case just up in Washington that happened where pharmacist took so much time looking at a prescription, trying to figure out if it was forgery, she called the police instead of calling the doctor. Patient was taken to jail, and only the judge could figure out that this was a legitimate cancer patient. those kinds of things are pretty common.
Well, one of the problems that's occurring, I think, nationally is a confusion between addiction and appropriate usage of opiate pain medications. We see that confusion occurring all the time, at least I do in my practice, where a patient is undertreated with respect to their pain medication, so they seek out another doctor, and it looks exactly like addiction behavior, when in fact the patient is seeking relief. If they're addicted to anything, it's pain relief. Once you get the pain under control using not only medications, but effective behavioral methods, putting all that together, time and again, in my experience working with multidisciplinary teams, we have seen the addiction-like behavior basically go away. It stops immediately once you attend to the condition in a proper manner.
If we're going to get the job done, we need primary care physicians to be willing to take this on as a normal, in the normal course of their everyday practice, just as they would treat diabetes or heart disease or hypertension or any of the number of things that are common. And yet what we have is a climate in this state which is actively discouraging physicians for fear of losing their licensure, for putting their malpractice at risk of being labeled as incompetent or at least misguided. And that atmosphere just has to change.
This allows me to get out of bed in the morning, to go for a walk with my dog, to see my grandchild, my first grandchild. I wouldn't have been able to do that before.
We know that when a person's in chronic or acute pain, that the sympathetic nervous system gets pretty stirred up. What we seek to do is to teach people how to actually control the nervous system to the degree that they can actually calm down that part of the nervous system. When that occurs, what we find is that the pain level actually is reduced. People are able to cope much better. They're able to control what's occurring in their body, and that gives them a great amount of relief.
Psychologists in this state are not even really licensed to treat chronic pain. And that's a primitive situation, because psychologists have a major, as we all know, role in treating the pain.
We're extremely concerned that in Oregon, state law restricts psychologists, who are normally the purveyors of these behavioral methods to treat chronic pain, restricts psychologists to treating only mental, emotional, and behavioral disorders. Says nothing about medical conditions such as chronic pain. So what that means is that the psychologist who chooses to treat chronic pain in Oregon goes out on a pretty precarious limb. They can be accused of, for example, practicing medicine without a license. Why should a psychologist do that and take that risk? The other option, of course, and this is what happens most of the time, the psychologist will end up diagnosing a psychiatric disorder or a mental illness to that patient in order to treat them. Now, that's unfair. A patient comes in with a migraine condition or with low back pain, some kind of medically based pain condition. Why should they be diagnosed with a mental illness in order to receive effective, valid behavioral treatment for their pain condition? It's just not right. Unfortunately, this is an example where statute is not up to speed with our science and our technology. There's an easy fix here. We need to add medical conditions to the list of conditions that psychologists in Oregon may treat.
One of the commission's recommendations with regard to improving the intractable pain bill has to do with deleting the requirement for a second opinion before starting pain management. Now, as a first look, this seems like a protection to the patient. We don't want for someone to have a curable problem, go undiagnosed, and be treated with pain medicine. But in practice, it's a really onerous requirement that
sets a level of care for a family physician well beyond what they're expected for any other medical condition. And it's particularly difficult to do that with people in nursing homes, with physicians who are practicing in rural areas, with people that are practicing with patients who are uninsured and are paying their own medical bills. It also reinforces that idea that someone is looking over your shoulder rather than trusting the physician to treat pain like they do the other problems which come into their office in a matter-of-fact, in a straightforward way, using the same care and caution of getting other opinions when needed, balancing the needs of the patient with their means, and all of those things that primary care physicians do are so naturally with any other medical condition.
We need to move ahead. There are real-life human beings who are counting on us, I think, to actually forge ahead and make some concrete changes occur.
All these things like taking care of my kids, doing my job very well, and being a nicer person because I wasn't in pain was the advantage.
The commission exists to help real people who are out there and real physicians who are out there. A lot of physicians want to know more and don't know more. A lot of patients are suffering, and they're suffering needlessly. And for both of those, this commission has to do the tough job. It can't afford to be window dressing.
Senator Tomei.
Thank you. Dr. Chino,
yes.
Do either of these bills...
I'm sorry, I've got to point the stop button here.
Okay. Do either of these bills provide for a psychologist prescribing medication for chronic pain?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could add one brief thing concerning the second opinion. I had a minor medical situation during the interim, and I needed my primary care physician sent me to a specialist. There was check on some minor nerve damage. That consultation, by the time we figured in the MRI and the and fortunately I'm covered by insurance, cost of it was nearly $1,800. Now, if we really want to get a handle on costs of medical treatment, having a primary care physician be able to institute pain management without putting the patient either, as we say, from a rural area or in a nursing home or even somebody that's covered by insurance, requiring them to go through this second opinion step that's not required for any other type of a condition is a real unnecessary expense when you've got the primary care physician who is a licensed doctor who wants to initiate treatment on their own. And I think that's besides the 6-week wait to get into to get the second opinion and delivery of service issues. I think that cost is something that we can save citizens of Oregon, and would appreciate you moving both of these pieces of legislation. Thank you.
I want to pause here for just a minute. We have a couple groups of students here, and I would like them to, we'll start over here with somebody, tell us who you are, where you're from. Hey, welcome. Nice, glad to have you here. And over here we have who?
Weston Middle School, Port Allsworth.
Good morning. Glad to have you with us. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Chino, I assume that nothing in this bill would prohibit the board to look in. If some doctor is doing nothing but prescribing tons of pain medication, they would certainly take a look at him. And I remember we had a case in Portland where somebody's putting out tons of Ritalin several years ago, and I would see that on the street being sold.
I think the, although I'm not a physician in the state, I'm a licensed psychologist, I think it's true with all the licensing boards that good practice is good practice.
Right.
And that there are policies, procedures in place to take care of problems that do arise when a physician or any other practitioner, for that matter, is practicing improperly. And I think what we're trying to do really is to zero in on those things that are actual barriers out there. And there's a big perception, as I think was made clear in the video, that there are the barriers, that physicians do perceive barriers, whether they're real or not. We need to work together to help reduce or clear those barriers to move us ahead.
Thank you.
Please.
Chair Cruz, last but not least, I am Kathy Hahn. I am a doctor of pharmacy. I practice in Springfield at a Bi-Mart. My specialty is chronic pain. I am the chair of the Pain Management Commission. I am also, I don't really have much more to say than has already been said. I just want to let you know that the commission supports these bills. We put them together and support them. I am also this year president of the Pain Society of Oregon, and we are the only multidisciplinary group in the state that focuses on pain education. And we also support these bills. And there you go.
Questions?
Just a quick question.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. These two bills wouldn't prevent a physician from wanting to get a second opinion, correct?
No.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Kathleen?
Good morning, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Medical Examiners. And I'm here to voice the board's concerns about portions of this bill. First, I think it's important to understand that there are really three types of pain. Acute, which would be after an injury or an accident or surgery. Intractable, which is the subject of these bills. And end-of-life pain. So there are really three types we're dealing primarily in this bill with, intractable pain. And the Board of Medical Examiners has a long history of supporting the medical goal of controlling a patient's pain so that the patient can function, which is our first point of disagreement with the bill, because the bill says that the goal should be controlling the patient's pain for the duration of the pain. One of our concerns about that language is that a physician will feel, I cannot take on an intractable pain patient, because if I do, then I need to stay with this patient for the duration of the pain. And I may not feel that I could ever discharge this patient. So that's one of our concerns about the bill. We feel that it would be appropriate to say, to control the patient's pain so that the patient can function, which is the goal in treating intractable pain. Now, with my testimony this morning, I did give you a copy of the board's packet on intractable pain, which we give to any of our physicians or other prescribers who have questions about the intractable pain law and the requirements under the statute. This is not just a concern in Oregon. It is a national concern. And to that end, the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners brought a resolution at the national level asking that the undertreatment of pain be looked at as carefully as the overprescribing for pain. So it's ironic that in some venues, Oregon is really in the front runner trying to get the whole scope of the problem examined. We do have a problem with removal of the second opinion, and intractable pain is not the only medical condition in which you would require a second opinion. And the board's concern is, let's say that a patient comes in with a headache, The board wants to be sure that the family practice physician or internist who's seeing that patient is also checking for something as extreme as a brain tumor before deciding that it just prescribing the pain medicine will alone treat the problem. So they want to make sure that the physician has the appropriate diagnosis. Now, in addition, on the back page of the bill provides that the board would have to dictate the forms that the physician has to use. This was discussed at length by the board when the bill came into being originally. And the board did not want to be the one saying you have to use this form, because then physicians would feel, again, handcuffed that, oh, we can't do it unless we have the board's form. The Medical Association drafted a form. We make that available if that's one a physician wants to use. If they want to use a different form, we don't have a problem with that. We don't want to have to, you know, be the ones dictating what form has to be used.
Question?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there other forms that the board develops that's required?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, not for any other medical practice that I'm aware of. So we are concerned about having just one form available to physicians, and we feel that that would actually inhibit them treating intractable pain patients. I think that in the words of Carol Misrak, who is the executive director for the Pain Commission, the Board of Medical Examiner is the entity that's used as an excuse by physicians who do not want to treat intractable pain. And it really requires a lot of multidisciplinary approach, as Mr. Chino said. It's very time-consuming, and it's costly because often physicians are not getting reimbursed. So it's really a multifactorial problem that results in patients not necessarily getting the adequate pain management. The board offers two appropriate prescribing courses a year, and our medical director tries to get out into the community to try to educate physicians about how to treat intractable pain patients. Again, this is the reason why the board has concerns about Senate Bill 436. We are in support of Senate Bill 434, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you
any
have.
Any questions? Representative Dalto.
Ms. Haley, are you a physician?
Representative Chair Cruz, Vice Chair Dalto, no, I'm not. I'm an attorney.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Carol Misrak.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name for the record is Carol Misrak. I am the pain management coordinator for the state of Oregon. In my role, I look at pain management throughout the state. I talk to physicians, I talk to patients, and I talk to providers as well. I want to say that Ms. Haley has been a wonderful resource for me, and I believe that our board is doing a very good job in their role of being a regulatory force. One of the things that I'd like to say is that, first of all, I personally feel, and from my interviews with people throughout the state, that one form really is best, because then everybody knows this is the form you use and this is the language that needs to be in that form, and so on and so forth. The fact that they also request one pharmacy is also a patient advocate issue. This patient obviously is taking polypharmacy, and they look for drug interactions, they look for problems with medications, and I think to have them use one pharmacy is a patient protection. Also, I do believe that we have physicians in the state that are using the board as their scapegoat. They'll say, I can't treat a patient because I fear that I'll be reprimanded. Mrs. Laver in the video reported much the same thing. That's what the physicians were telling her. However, we've spoken to the board. We've looked at their records. We have looked at how many doctors they've sanctioned. And actually, in our state, it's very few. But and the state medical, the Board of Medical Examiners and the OMA and the Pain Commission are all working closely so that we can get better pathways for physicians to treat pain. I agree with Ms. Haley about the fact that we cannot force physicians to treat pain, but I do feel that if we educate physicians, they will be much more willing to treat pain because it is not any different than another chronic illness, as in diabetes. And we would not take away a diabetic's medications just because they're non-compliant. That's when the psychologists and the social workers and so on and so forth come into the picture so that we can treat these people holistically. We can deal with their issues holistically. And that's why I really feel that in passing Senate Bill 436, that we will have those protections, not only for the patient, but for the board and for all of us. We're saying you can treat pain. And that's all I have to say.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close public hearings on Senate Bills 434 and 436, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 434.
Mr. Chair, I move the amendment. It comes to us amended, right?
So these are finished products.
Okay. I move Senate Bill 434 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Well, no, not as amended.
It's already.
Okay. All right.
It's just an engrossed is what we have.
Great.
So.
I move it to 434 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 434 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And none. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 434, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Anderson, do you want to carry?
But on 436.
Not on this bill. What's the pleasure? Does somebody want to carry this?
Or I'd be happy to carry it.
Okay, Representative Tomei will carry Senate Bill 434, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 434, open a work session on Senate Bill 436. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from Ms. Haley again. I'm not quite sure what I heard her recommendation on this bill. Ms. Haley, as I understood it, you supported 434, but
not this one.
Wanted to have more work on 436.
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, that's correct. And I think that the form issue is one that, in discussions with the Pain Commission, there was some agreement. I didn't hear that this morning, that they did want to have one form, and they wanted it to come from the board. And as I said, the board's concerned that a couple of the provisions will actually have a deleterious effect on physicians' willingness to serve these patients, which we have tried to encourage around the state. But if we say you can only use our form and you have to take the patient so long as the patient has the pain, those are two areas that we have concerns may actually have the opposite effect.
Kathleen, as I read it, it doesn't say they have to keep them for the duration. What it says is that they would not be subject to discipline for the duration. There's nothing in there that speaks to the fact that once they've taken a patient, they have to keep them.
Chair Cruz, it says with the goal of controlling the patient's pain for the duration of the pain. And this is based upon my discussions with our medical director. And as I said, I'm not a physician, but he is. And he's the one that's been around the state and giving the courses and hearing from physicians. And that was his concern. So I'm here really.
Well, I understand the concern, but as I read the language, I don't see this as a requirement necessarily to continue treating. Once you've started.
The board's thought was just that if you amended it to say with the goal of controlling the patient's pain so that the patient can function, that it would work better in the community.
Did you have a chance to make that suggestion on the Senate side of
I did.
That amendment?
I did.
Okay. Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a concern about Section 2. That's the second page, line 10. It reads, in the form provided and approved by the board. And my concern sort of stems from, the concern that I would have that if you had multiple forms or more than one form or you didn't have an agreement on these forms that there would be some sort of exposure to liability issues for providers. And I just kind of wanted to get a better discussion about that from both sides if we could. But I don't know if that's possible.
Who else do you want to hear from, Representative?
Pain management.
Carol, maybe?
Yeah.
But I'd like to hear from the board as well.
When this bill was initially placed in 95, I think, or 97 session, Chair Cruz, Representative Dalto, there was discussion among the board members, and at that time we even had a board member whose sole practice, when this bill came in, whose sole practice was pain management. That's all she does in Klamath Falls, and she takes a multidisciplinary approach. And the concern was that if the board dictates the form, you're going to have physicians worried they don't have the right form so they can't prescribe. And we didn't want that to be a hang-up. We wanted them to be able to set up their own form or their own way of informing patients about some of the risks involved in long-term controlled substance prescribing.
I hear physicians telling me that they fear that they don't have everything included in the form, or what do they want included in the form. I guess my feeling is, and I certainly understand what Ms. Haley is saying, because it, you know, if treatment is delayed for lack of a form, that would be a onus. That would be not a good thing to happen. But I think if we distribute these forms early on and that every physician's office gets them, that would be taken care of. But it's just my experience through talking to people that they fear that they won't include all of the points in the agreement.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I guess I'm unclear about the form itself. Is this a separate form for intractable pain?
Chair Cruz, Vice Chair Dalto, I did provide a copy there with my testimony. There are a couple of recommended forms that we do send out. We put these, they came from the Medical Association. I'm trying to, it's right after the statute and administrative rule. There's a checklist, and then there's an informed consent with the material risks form. Mm-hmm. We wonder why physicians are having trouble these days. You look at all the paperwork.
Yeah.
No kidding.
So then you go into the notice for a special one for controlled substances for intractable pain. So those are the forms we're talking about.
One thing I would like to mention is that not only intractable pain, but physicians are having contracts with patients for other chronic disease states. It merely identifies what the patient can expect of the physician, what the physician can expect of the patient, and what they together will do to work as a team for the betterment of the patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morris Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having concerns, too, about the form, only because forms are changing all the time and need to be updated because, as you've said, we are really, or I think Senator Duke said, we are miles ahead today than we were 10 years ago. And now with electronic, charting, will an electronic form be admissible? I wish that there could be consensus between the people who are actually providing the services, the physicians, and the way of tracking or completing the record. To me, that's significant, having been someone who's charted and charted and charted and very worried about having the right form.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to see the groups get together and work on this. Do we have time to...
and bring it back Friday.
And bring it back. Well...
yes.
I'm willing to do that. And we can reschedule for Friday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See if you can come up with some...
Can we have something new? She wants to respond.
Senator, just so you'll know, we might have a constitutional problem here.
I heard.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, because I was out in another committee, I'm not sure entirely what you're dealing with. I do understand that now, excuse me, but for the first time, someone has raised an issue over the charting, and you need to understand why the commission asked to put this in the bill. And they may have already explained this to you, but we have physicians who, in the process of the investigation, then someone has said, well, you didn't chart this, you didn't chart that, you didn't, you know, you have, and physicians are using a variety of different forms. And so we simply said, well, if the Board of Medical Examiners is the licensing board, and they are going to do the investigation, and they have concerns about what should and shouldn't be in those files, then let's have them produce the form so that they have control over what a physician should and shouldn't be putting on the form. And in response to Representative Mona Sanderson's question, of course they can be done electronically. The board can change them at any point in time. They can add, they can subtract, they can do whatever they want to with them, because the bill leaves it up to the board to create the form, so they can be shifted. I would tell you that if it is a hang-up, that the rest of the bill is far more important to us than that line is. We were simply trying to make it easier for physicians to not run afoul of that when they get into an investigation situation, assuming that they actually use the form that was provided by them, and to provide some clarity as to what kinds of things they needed to be charting and keeping in their patients' folders. So it seemed to us a clarifying issue. If it now at the 11th hour has become a divisive issue, it's not one that's worth hanging on to.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Monson.
In follow-up, I would love to see just that piece deleted and then let the board, by rule or whatever, come up with the concept, something. They should be able to come up with something that the physicians would want. I see the importance of this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, there are a lot of things that I wish the board would do by rule that the board chooses not to do. And that is a frustration to me. I am not a licensed physician. I am not on the board. So I am a casual observer who gets frustrated from time to time. And it is entirely the purview of the board to decide what they do or don't do. They have chosen not to do this for a whole lot of years, so I wouldn't hold out a whole lot of hope that they were going to change their minds anytime soon. But we can certainly continue the way we have been going. May not be a great situation, but it's a situation.
Just follow up. Yeah. I won't get into that argument, but I would. Pain is such. People are living longer lives, and pain is such a part of many people's lives right now. So I'm very thankful that you're bringing these forward. The fact that the board doesn't require any forms for any kind of illness or disease is an issue, and I don't have the answer on how that could be taken care of, but I'd like to see the bill move.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Representative Westland.
Is there any way, assuming we have the constitutional required votes here today, that we could pass this bill and there could be an accommodation reached between the board and some of the proponents of the
I'll tell you what I'm going to suggest, and this goes, Senator Dukes and I sat on the original Pain and Symptom Management Task Force in 98, so we've been at this for a while. What we could do, colleagues, because there is still some question over the language on Section 1, Line 10, I would like to move this. If we could make a conceptual amendment to delete the new language in Section 2, then it would go back to the Senate and we could form a conference to make sure everything was the way it should be. Would that be acceptable, Senator? Conference committees can be wonderful things.
Mr. Chair, I would have to speak with the chairman of the Senate committee it came out of. My inclination would be if it came back to the Senate to recommend to him that he concurred. I have to be honest.
Which would be fine too. But I'm kind of agreeing with the senator on. You know, I'm not sure the form is a bad thing, and like I said, we've been at this for a long time, and we have basically had to push the envelope to get anything. Okay, that's just the nature of the beast, and I look at that as basically pushing the envelope. But my sense of the committee is that there's discomfort with having the language about the form in here, so. I'm going to ask for unanimous consent to suspend the rules for the purposes of conceptually amending Senate Bill 436. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the rules are suspended. I would entertain, or the chair is going to move that we conceptually amend Senate Bill 436 by removing from Section 2, Lines 10 and 11, the words, in a form provided and approved by the board. Is everybody clear on the conceptual amendment? Are there any objections to the conceptual amendment? Seeing none, the conceptual amendment is adopted. So now I would entertain a motion on the bill as conceptually amended. Representative Barker.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 436, as conceptually amended, be moved to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 436 as conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Representative Dalto?
Just a procedural question, Mr. Chair. What happens if the Senate rejects the House amendment?
If the Senate does not concur with the House amendments, a conference committee will be set up. The Senate President and the Speaker will appoint members to that conference committee, usually from the committees that heard the bill. They will come together and try to figure out how they can resolve the differences.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've kind of gotten turned around on this. I thought we were saying that the board is the body to which we ought to turn to bring all of the forms into line and one, have one standardized form. Am I? Is that not...
Well, that's not what we're doing now.
No, we're turning it around.
Yes, we are, but that's what the committee wanted, so that's where we are. Representative Tomei.
Well, I guess I'm following up on Representative Anderson's concern, too. It seems to me, I mean, if that's what we need to do to pass the bill, I will certainly go along with that. But it seems to me that it's not out of line to require that the BME come up with a form that everybody can agree with. So, I mean, I guess that's what it needs to pass the bill. But I guess it wouldn't be inappropriate for this committee to ask the BME to come up with such a form.
Senator, did this come out of Senator Morissette's committee? Will you have a conversation with Senator Morissette that maybe non-concurrence might be the appropriate thing?
I will.
So I don't want to go back and unconceptually amend a conceptual amendment. Folks. I mean, Ramona is mad enough when I do what I'm doing now. So,
if it's the will of the committee, could we vote this conceptual?
We already approved the conceptual amendment.
Right, but we could vote the bill down and then reintroduce the bill as written here, depending on the will of the committee.
Representative,
I still
have issue with the form for all providers. Okay. I really do.
Let's pass the bill as we've amended it, and then we'll have some time to make sure that we can address these issues. I mean, if nothing else, you know, I mean, the first rule of the legislature should be to do no harm, I think. And, well, us too, but we tend to ignore that most of the time. But, you know, we aren't making things worse by that.
No.
We could potentially make it better. So,
I agree.
Yeah, we could always reconsider. But at this point, do we have a motion on the bill?
Yes, we do.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Any more?
If I don't get to vote on this, I'm going to be a no. Little Zen stuff for you.
That means he's going to vote yes.
Okay. if you don't get to vote, how could you be a no?
I'm always a no.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Do you want me to repeat the motion?
No, but I reserve the right to change my vote on the floor.
Aye.
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 Senate Bill 436, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and Representative Barker will carry. And thanks for the journey. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 436. Open a work session on Senate Bill. Oh, excuse me. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 162. Sandy.
I know. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 162 comes from the Senate Committee on Human Resources. It's requiring the licensees of the Board of Naturopathic Examiners to have graduated from an accredited naturopathic school or college. Excuse me.
We have a little decorum, please.
Modifies the requirement for license renewal. Increases the number of continuing education requirements for licensees. It left the committee with five to one excused vote. It left the Senate floor with all unanimous consent, 30 ayes.
Controversial, obviously. Please, go ahead.
Good morning, Greg. Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Greg Garcia. I'm a licensed naturopathic physician and the chair of the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners. This bill has been worked through our open sessions, and we're recommending and suggesting that you pass this. The areas that are addressed in this bill briefly is the current statute says that we approve naturopathic medical schools. Of course, we have the oldest one in the country here in Portland, and Portland is now the college there is accredited to the Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges. So what the board wants to do is remove the board from approving schools and simply going with if the schools are accredited by the Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges, that should meet the statutory requirements for licensure. There's other minor details here, as you heard, regarding continuing education, that if a licensee had not sent in their fees by the end of the year, their license would be revoked. We felt that that is too strong, and so we're adding a new term, lapsed, and leaving revoked for basically disciplinary reasons. The final change in this part of the bill is that as chair, I'm referred to as chair, and the statute says I'm president, and so we just wanted to sort of update the terminology.
Any questions?
You.
Stay right there.
Okay.
No questions?
I'm sorry.
I'm still
reading the bill here. I forgot. Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. Who would accredit or approve?
Currently, it's the Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges, which accredits all universities or institutions that get more than one degree. So that's where they're currently in standing.
So the place would still stay the same?
That's right.
What you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, now? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 162, open a work session on Senate Bill 162.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 162 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 162 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Anderson.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the same bill that I was thinking of that that recognizes naturopathic physicians as physicians, but in the context of the bill.
No, that's a different.
That's
bill.
A different bill.
Yeah.
Any other discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Barker. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Aye. Excused. Aye.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 162 to the consent calendar.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 162 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 162 having received the required majority is declared passed. Close the work session on Senate Bill 162. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 163.
Thank you, Representative Cruz, Chair, and the members of the committee. This bill is a amending our statute under disciplinary causes that we can add a category called a letter of reprimand that previously we did not have that ability, and the Attorney General's recommendation for our board was to include that as an option for the board. And then the other one there is that also be able to impose a civil penalty that prior to this the statute was you could either do one or the other, and at times we would like to have the flexibility to do both.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
I'm just quickly looking this over. I just got it today. Lines 20 and 21 on the first page. So this would, if one were to commit to a mental institution a patient, then they may be issued a letter of reprimand. Is that correct?
No. This would be if there's a licensee, in other words, a naturopathic physician that's in a mental health institution, that if they're committed into an institution themselves, that if we feel they that it's not safe for the public to be treated by that physician, that we could suspend their license as an example. It's not directly related to a letter of reprimand or anything like that. I can't imagine the board sending them unless they're continuing to practice while they're committed.
That'd be kind of hard, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well,
one would think.
Never know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? One work session, right? Did I do that yet?
No.
Oh, I didn't? Oh, okay. A closed public hearing on Senate Bill 163. Open a work session on Senate Bill 163.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 163 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 163 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Anderson.
Aye.
Mr. Barker.
Aye.
Ms.
Adolfo.
Aye.
Ms.
Yeah, aye.
Ms.
Aye.
Representative
Wesley. Excused. Aye.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that to the consent calendar.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 163 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 163, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I close the work session on Senate Bill 163. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 164. Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thanks for coming on, by the way.
You're welcome. Senate Bill 164 is a bill to expand the Board of Naturopathic Examiners from 5 members, 4 licensees, and 1 public member to 7, which would include 1 additional licensee and another public member. The Board of Naturopathic Examiners since 1927 has had 5 members, and the number of licensees in the state of Oregon, for instance, at the end of 1998, was around 260 or 50. At the end of 2002, had practically doubled to about 515. So the number of concerns, the number of complaints for 4 members has been extensive, and so we were hoping to include, to expand it, and to allow, I think, just a little bit more efficiency, because we are funded by other funds. This does not affect the general funds, and we're essentially volunteering our time. So we felt that this would make a more palatable, I would say, for physicians in the state as naturopaths to volunteer their services.
Questions? Sounds reasonable. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 164. Open a work session on Senate Bill 164.
Mr. Chair, I move 164 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 164 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused? Aye. Representative Barker.
Mr. Chair, move this to the consent calendar as well.
Representative Barker moves that Senate Bill 164 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? So ordered. Senate Bill 164, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 164. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 393.
Mr. Chair,
Thank you, members
of the committee, Senate Bill 393 comes from the Senate Committee on Human Resources. It moved off the Senate floor with a 26 aye vote, one no vote, and one excuse vote, and a couple of legislative business. The bill adds naturopathic physicians to a list of medical professionals who may conduct physical examinations required by students who are participating in sports.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Art Kyle. I represent the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, appearing here today on behalf of Senate Bill 393. I'm passing out to you a brochure that looks something like this, and I would like to call your attention to the section that says, what about training? Because there was some confusion when I spoke with each member regarding the training of naturopathic physicians. An individual graduates from a Bachelor of Science degree program in science, applies to a naturopathic college, spends 4 years in the naturopathic medical college undergoing approximation of the same medical training that OSHU provides. And that is indicated in here, and I think it's worth pointing that that issue out. There is an emphasis on prevention and nutrition in the naturopathic profession that in some instances is not as predominant in the MD programs. The Senate last session passed a bill, Senate Bill 160, which provided for physical examinations for students participating in sports. That bill provided for MDs, PAs, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and chiropractic physicians to give those physical examinations. The reason the association did not comment on that bill is because it was assumed naturopathic physicians fit the category of practicing physicians. I met with the Department of Education to work with the department to institute rules for the physical examination itself. They told me that they had opposition to including naturopaths, and I met with the director, Mr. Stan Bunn, who said, why don't you get a legal opinion to show that naturopathic physicians are included as licensed physicians? We did, in fact, get that position. That position, and I included in the packet of materials that I gave to each of you. The Attorney General did indicate that physicians for this statute would be considered physicians, and so I gave that to the Department of Education. They, in turn, decided to object to that. And from that time on, for a two-year period of time, I run through a myriad of concerns by the Department of Education, obfuscation, and so on, that is just unimaginable. So this bill is merely a device intending to clarify, by placing naturopathic physicians in the statute, that they are, in fact, included to do sports physical. It's worth noting, Mr. Chairman, members, that naturopathic physicians routinely conduct physical examinations for adults and children in their practice. And so we assume that this is a reasonable position to take. Mr. Chairman, members, this is not a scope of practice issue. This is not including physicians in a program that is different from what is in practice at this present time. And I do know that the OMA will oppose this position, as they do every bill that we present in the legislature. But I brought with me Dr. Aris Campbell, who will speak on the issue of what naturopaths do and what their training is. Dr. Campbell?
That's me. My name is Dr. Aris Campbell, also known as Andy Campbell. Representative Cruz and committee, thanks for letting me talk on this bill. I have done medicine ever since I was a teenager. In preparation for going to Vietnam, I became a registered nurse, and I practiced in hospitals as a registered nurse for 15 years, mostly working in intensive care units, open heart surgery recovery units. By the time I was in pre-med, I was a hospital supervisor. My first job that I worked in, I was at OHSU, which is the training hospital for physicians in Oregon. And I don't know if you realize it, but nurses have a big role to play in training physicians at that hospital. At some point, I became aware of that there were other issues in medicine that weren't being addressed, and so I pursued another path that led me to become a naturopathic physician. The educational process of becoming a naturopathic physician is quite specific. Back when I became one, I was licensed in 1987, so I started about in the late 70s to become one, you did not need to have a bachelor's degree. At this point, it is required for our medical schools to have a bachelor's degree. It's not required in other medical schools. The nutritional requirements, every term that we're in school, all 4 years, we're required to take a class in nutrition. Most medical schools only require one class, and you can take that or leave it if you want to. In Oregon, and in most of the country, we're kind of the underdog physicians. We're always trying to show that we're good enough. At least we always have been. And several decades ago, we decided that one of the best ways to do that was to fashion our educational process after OHSU. So we did. And what you'll find now, if you go to NCNM, is almost an exact duplicate of that program, plus other programs germane to natural medicine. When I was a teaching resident, part of my responsibility was to teach second-year medical students how to give physical exams, and I can assure you that that's a very rigorous program. We take that very seriously. The physical exams that naturopathic physicians give to people are the exact physical exams taught out of the exact books in the exact way that every other medical doctor in the state gives a physical exam. The difference may be that we're held to a standard of higher scrutiny because we're not seen as real doctors by some people. So we really try harder in a lot of cases to do a better job.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the names of the medical schools where a naturopathic physician is trained?
National College of Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine in Arizona, in Phoenix, Arizona, and then John Bastier University up in Seattle, and I believe they've opened up, I think there's two of them on the East Coast.
Thank you.
Representative Clement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Campbell, so naturopathic physicians are being trained. You mentioned OHSU, and I did my second year of training at OHSU, so I know what you're saying about nurses training physicians. But do naturopathic physicians have the same opportunity to study in a teaching hospital?
Yes.
And where would that be?
We study in our, not in a hospital. Part of what happens in legislative events, and I've been coming to the legislature for 10 years or more now, we have people that oppose us on different issues, whether it's good for the public or not. One of the bills that we put in about 10 years ago was to allow us to do residencies in hospitals. That was shot down. The complaint was that we didn't do residencies in hospitals. But then when we tried to make it so that we could, it was prevented. At this point, when I graduated from school, there were six official residency spots available in the country. And because of my background as a nurse and the technical things that they saw me as knowing, they chose me for a residency program. So I got to do a residency in family practice.
Where did you do that?
Where? At National College of Naturopathic Medicine Teaching Clinic.
But
so
what
it's,
I'm
it's
asking
not
is,
an inpatient. No, there are no inpatient.
No, not at a teaching hospital. Is that what I'm hearing?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Representative Anderson.
Our backgrounding here mentions that naturopathic medicine is a discipline that includes physiotherapy, natural healing processes, and minor surgery. What are the surgical procedures that a naturopathic doctor might do? Or is that not necessarily true?
Yeah, it is true. Okay. Minor surgery techniques, not going into major body cavities, is where we stop at a fascial level. The main things that I've done are, you know, taking off warts, stitching up skin, knee, things like that. If you have a facial wound, I mean, we're family practice doctors by definition. We are fashioned to be family practice doctors. We cannot specialize by law, and that's what we do.
Do most naturopathic physicians deliver babies?
No, you have to have a special
certification
in order to do that. And you do go above and beyond it, and as far as your experience level. You have to do like 55 births with a person who is already certified and then take a special test.
Mr. Chairman, if I may address it, hemorrhoidectomies are also performed by naturopaths. If I may step back to the issue of hospitals, this is really a catch-22, Representative.
We're using hospitals now.
The profession is using clinics throughout the Portland area for the residency programs that they're involved in. It's a terrible admission, but the reason I think, as Dr. Campbell points out, that naturopaths do not function in hospitals because the hospital boards are staffed by MDs who refuse to allow naturopaths admission to their hospital privileges.
May I speak? My goal as a professional is to integrate naturopathic medicine with what we consider regular medicine. I've worked with medical doctors in a partner-type basis for the last 7 or 8 years, and I think that that's the best for everybody. I think that, you know, having grown up in hospitals literally, that including naturopathic physicians in hospitals would be very good for patients. I think it would be very cost effective. I've been a naturopathic physician for 15 years. I was a registered nurse for 15 years. I was a hospital supervisor. I ran an intensive care unit. And it's my opinion that by integrating alternative medicine with regular medicine, we're going to have the best product for Oregonians available.
Representative Morris Anderson.
Thank you. Are you afraid of the liability issues? You know, we have so many students who are now dying on the football field from an aneurysm or a brain tumor.
No, not in the least.
Cardiac arrest.
Not any more than any other physician would be. You know, I don't think any physician is perfect, but I have good training. I'm careful with what I do, and I do the best job that I can. I also carry liability insurance.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Scott.
For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. I guess as an opening comment, the association apparently doesn't oppose every naturopathic bill. I believe the committee just moved three bills prior to this particular bill. I'm not aware of any medical conspiracy about this particular arena. Having said that, it's not really the issue before the committee. The issue before the committee is one that began actually last session with a Senate bill that the Medical Association, in fact, supported to require students, grade 7 through, I believe it's 7 through 12, to have physicals in order to try to detect medical problems, physical problems, prior to participating in sports. And if the legislation goes on to say that if you do in fact find a diagnosis where there is that problem or a problem, that the student is required 2 years later to have another exam. What we did object to in the legislation was including chiropractors in the list of those who might provide the physical exams, particularly because of the concern over detecting cardiopulmonary diseases and defects. And we predicted at that time, even though we had qualifying language inserted into the bill, we predicted at that time that the Board of Chiropractic Examiners would merely adopt a rule essentially saying that chiropractors have the training and experience to diagnose cardiopulmonary diseases, which is exactly what the Board of Chiropractors did. Similarly, merely having a course on physiology does not make one qualified, at least from our view, in the determination of whether or not a patient has a heart problem or other more sophisticated medical problem like a tumor or other things. And so we were concerned about being sure that young athletes were appropriately examined to detect whether there were serious medical problems that might occur on the sports field. So essentially this bill does the same thing. It essentially, and you can predict it, and is presumed that naturopathic physicians believe that they are qualified to diagnose and treat cardiopulmonary diseases and defects, which is a little contrary actually to at least the philosophy of naturopathic medicine, which is based on the body healing itself, and it does seem a little contradictory in the scheme of things. So the policy issue before the committee really is whether or not it is appropriate in the requirement of having examinations of young athletes being done by appropriate personnel. If you adopt or if you move this legislation forward, you're making a clear statement that you believe that naturopathic physicians are, in fact, duly qualified to do what we expressed our concern was in regard to Senate Bill 160 from last session, I think it's unfortunate at times that boards merely choose to, by rule, adopt a standard saying, well, we are in fact qualified, without any elucidation of clinical training or experience in those requirements that then enable those practitioners to perform diagnostic tests or presumably procedures that they may not be as well qualified as one would hope. Those would be our observations, Mr. Chairman.
Scott, what kind of diagnostic tests and procedures accompany a school sports physical?
Well, Mr. Chairman, clearly you would do a normal physical and history, which is one issue.
I mean, have they changed from way back when we were...
You know, Mr. Chairman, to be honest with you, I haven't had a physical in quite some time, which is probably not appropriate, but...
Do you know any doctors?
I know a few physicians. I'm pretty confident I'm not overweight.
You smoke.
I think...
That's not a health risk.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, it is a health risk, and I am unfortunately guilty, But again, the policy issue is the one that I presented to you, and it was an objection and a concern that we raised with the underlying legislation. And we believe that this bill fundamentally sets a policy standard that is inappropriate in this regard. And you are, in fact, while admittedly there are a small number of young men and women who might have serious heart problems or other medical problems, it is a potential risk in adopting this policy that you might not otherwise pick it up.
But even number one, I'm not necessarily sure that the number of athletic-related deaths has increased dramatically. It's just being reported more. But the ones that have been most dramatic have been the professional athletes who have rigorous physicals and still aren't detected. I mean, some of those things, unless you're gonna do a CAT scan or an electrocardiogram or something like that, you're not going to see those things.
Mr. Chair,
I guess because what we're looking at here is your basic high school sports physical, correct?
Mr. Chairman, I will reiterate what our concern was before. It is the same concern today. And essentially what this bill says is that these practitioners are, in fact, capable and trained to treat and diagnose cardiopulmonary diseases. And the way the Board of Chiropractic Examiners interpreted the statute was merely to adopt a rule essentially saying that we are, in fact, trained and capable of doing that. That was their way of getting around the limiting language that we had in the underlying legislation. So that is your choice to make, but the association feels obligated to at least present it to the committee, and that's probably why you make the big bucks, Mr. Chairman, to make those choices.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to go over the things that usually are covered in a sports physical, usually it's looking at the eyes, ears, nose, mouth, and then putting a stethoscope out and listening to the heart, front, back, lungs, you know, and doing the height, weight. I think that's about it.
Typical.
They don't even do a urine, do they, in a sports
Do they probably do.
They do a urine then also. Okay. I just wanted to clarify.
Blood pressure?
Right, they do blood,
yes.
Yeah.
Blood pressure.
Typical.
Senator Barker, do you have a question?
Well, I guess my question, thank you, Scott. I appreciate you coming up and sharing your concerns, but we already allow physician's assistants, certified nurse practitioners, and then the chiropractic physicians as well. And I think I'm fairly satisfied with the testimony we've had that the naturopathic physicians are trained to where they could certainly give a high school physical test. I'm not...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, again, in negotiating the bill that was introduced last session, we did attempt to make qualifying language operative in this legislation. I realize who was included in the bill originally, and what we attempted to do in setting some parameters within the context of that legislation. We believe that the underlying policy issue of doing these examinations is a good one and an important one in order to avoid, hopefully avoid, a young man or woman having a serious medical problem when they participate in athletics. You know, the policy itself is a good one. We attempted to put qualifying language in the bill that would put some parameters around the practitioners. Obviously, we were not successful. This bill would merely perpetuate that problem, and I think we can fairly predict the same sort of policy statement and regulation from the Board of Naturopathy as the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. I think it's predictable.
And if I also saw the letter from the AG's office saying that naturopathics were physicians. I mean, they considered that under the law that they qualified.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I saw that as well. I would disagree with that, with their conclusion, but again, it's a matter of, I guess, choice.
And then just one other anecdotal story. I saw a MD when I was in high school, and they said I had a heart murmur, prohibited me from playing sports, and it turned out that was a misdiagnosis, but better safe than sorry, I guess.
You know, and you'd been good, too, I can tell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I was a student athlete through college, and no one ever was fortunate enough to tell me that I didn't have to work that hard on two-a-days for a long time, so yeah. I appreciate it.
What sport?
I was an All-American diver in high school and NCAA stuff in college, springboard diving. Gravity is a wonderful thing.
Timmy Wiggs, bridge team.
Yeah. Any other, as fast as you.
Any other questions? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 434. Thank you, Scott. 393, excuse me. And open a work session on Senate Bill 393.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 393 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 393 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Anderson.
Nay.
Senator Barker.
Aye.
Senator Belso.
Excused.
Senator
Monica
Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Wesley.
Aye.
Senator Wesley. Aye. Senate Bill 393, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Tomei, would you?
Yes, I'd be delighted.
Representative Tomei will carry and close the work session on Senate Bill 393. And having no other business, we are adjourned.
Good.
Yes.